Accession number 11106, Mr. T. Wilson, Reel 11.
Mr. T. Wilson, Reel 11. You mentioned that you were on patrols quite often, Mr. Wilson. Can you describe to me the action of actually going out on and coming back from a patrol? Did it start with a briefing? Were you briefed at all before you went as to what you should do?
Yes, well, most, it all depends on the type of patrol. The sergeant might be in charge you on, but if it's required definite or specified or best important information, would say, you'd have an officer in charge yet. The officer would be there, would be a sergeant, and about six or seven fellas we have, or four or five fellas we have. Not like an individual. A patrol would consist an officer, sergeant, and about six other ranks. Really. That was called a full patrol, really.
And you had these special boots, as a rule, that's kept quiet. What other forms of dress or equipment or coloration of your
well,
skin?
You didn't blacken your face and nothing like that. You more or less, you had the overall, the horse puffies, and the same colors as sand and things like that. But on the night time, well, it was more or less a night time patrol, because you couldn't do a patrol during the day, far from it. The hours and night time or evening time, when you got to a certain area, then the darkness come, and you get in your danger zone. Now, what you had to do, your officer would be either your compass. He knew the direction he was going. He'd also know the amount of ground he had to cover, say, half a mile, or 800 yards, so it all depends on what area of what this information was sought from. And then there'll be the sergeant in charge with you. And then you'd have one bloke every 10 yards or 20 yards with tie knot and lump of string, we'll say. They might affect every area patrol like that, but that was our idea, more or less, or what was established by us. And also, you'd have somebody on the left to keep his eye open, and somebody on the right to keep his eye open. And you're all still in touch in one line. You didn't stray too far away. Well, you're nearly in touching distance, really. And you keep, because the fella in the centre, he was centre pin. Therefore, if you didn't keep in line with that, you were going to be lost. So therefore, you did advance under his orders in regard to that. And that's where a good patrol was conducted. Somebody on the left, somebody on the right. Somebody know how many paces you took. Somebody know the bearing. Then you had to, he reverse his back bearing, and he get you back with a reasonable area. If you had to scatter, you know, like get away sharp or just come back normal, you get back within the reasonable area of that. Not a patrol. But sometimes patrols only went out for information. They didn't go out sometimes for fire. Oh, no. No, but many a time a patrol wasn't required to go out for information. When you're on defensive thing like that, the old saying was the high ups had to get as much information where who was there or where they were. They wanted that information and they worked on that. The different reports from different areas give them a built up picture of what they required. We didn't realize, or we only paid our regional part, but all them little parts built up made a picture for the HQ. Not what required, but no, regard fighting, never. Not very often. You wouldn't even send out the fight on patrol. That's definite. You're more or less in Tobruk, you're on defensive, and you don't defend the patrol. Get out, get information, and get back.
How close did you get?
Well, you could hear your heart beating, or you sit down, and you're lying on the ground, and you pulling you together, checking up that everything's all right, how far you've gone, anything like that. You can hear your heart beating, bump, bump, bump on the ground. Oh, yes, you can hear that heart beating. and there's nobody coughs either. That's one thing. You don't, if you to stifle a cough, oh yes, you will stifle it. You could hear the voices at times. You might be playing the mouth organ, something like that. Well, but distance in the night time, sound in the night time, is nearly three times more than what you imagine it is. It might be, say, 50 yards away, but in the night time you can guarantee it, it could be 200 yards away or 150 yards away. The distance and sound in the night time is calculated out, it's very clear. Sound can travel on the night time more than what you think. You know, when you're just speaking ordinary, you think, oh, well, your voice dies down soon. But believe me, on the night time, it seems to travel at least half a mile. That's definitely not the slightest sound. Yes, we heard the sound of the fellas talking and yapping, shouting, whatever they were. Well, I would say to myself personally, good Lord, they're no more than 20 yards in front of us.
You never did a patrol for bringing back with the aim of bringing back a prisoner?
Never. No, no. Our aim was where they were, and that means if they want to lay the artillery on them and things like that, they knew what bend the corn, they knew what they, or if we wanted to break through or shift them, the high ups had to work. They worked all that out. Everybody was doing patrols, more or less. It was a patrol system. Because if you don't go forward and you sit still, you've had it. But you've got to always get to know as much about the enemy. The more the better you get to know about them, the better your defences are. And Tobruk was morally solely defensive position. It wasn't trying to bring him back.
Was there much activity with regard to flares and artillery during the...
Well, those signals were flares and what they call a very light pistol and things like that. We saw you see it when they were, if you speak on the night time and a different colour might go up. Well, we didn't know nothing about that colour because it was no information. But it was in our area. Concerned us, we were given information about it. But otherwise, those flares going up in different places. And as regards the aircraft in Tobruk, oh, dear me.
It was heavy bombing raids.
When they come on the harbour part, that the aircraft was good fireworks for anybody to see in the sky. And everything was let loose. Because there's artillery aircraft and quite a lot of defences down there. Not just a downlight infantry, far from it. But everybody had to play their little part. And believe me, there was some, you never seen any better artillery fire or aircraft fire or on a bomber raid to Brook. Malta gave it a good show, but the Brook Harbour boy, it went up because they got a supply of ammunition there for them to do it. Well, Malta didn't. Malta had a good firework display, because it was. But not as good to Tobruk one, because the Tobruk lads had the ammunition.
How was it, how did you sleep? If during the day you couldn't move, night time must have been a time when you really could get active. How did you sleep, and when did you sleep?
Well, normally sleep comes on to you, and you get, sleep wasn't a great deal, probably, because you were just lying in the sand, more than in a little slit sense, and with your little comfortable bit.
Was this usually during the day more than...
Oh, yes. You were always below ground. Well, as I say, below ground, not down deep. You might be a foot below the ground, or you might have a decent sit sense and a bit wide one, but you didn't want it too big for observation from the sky. Because, I mean, you get little slits from the photograph of the sky. You've got to keep your own little place camouflaged. Because they're getting over the troops here, well, you've got to, all right, oh, well, good, you want to dig a one, the best for your ability and that, but from observation point of view in the air, it's detrimental to you. So therefore, you've got to camouflage everybody, haven't you?
What is the size and dimensions of a good slip trench?
Well, just about the length of your body, that's all, and then about 2 foot deep.
And how did you camouflage it?
Anything you got hold of? Didn't matter what it was. There wasn't very little to get hold of, but the equipment was more or less the same colour as that day, but your tin helmet, which you hope for all, was a different colour, things like that, but you hadn't much camouflage, we hadn't much camouflage nets. They had an HQ and things like that. They had the, but forward, no, it's enormously changed. The back areas, where the what we call the brain zones would be, they'd be well camouflaged. No bother was given to them, nor us.
There weren't permanent defences where you were, concrete defences of any kind?
No, definitely not. And Tobruk, no, we had no permanent concrete defences, never. None to Brook we hadn't. And the Durham hadn't, and then somebody else might have had, but I can't really say that. No, though. I don't think there was anybody else had either. I never heard of any.
Did they keep you informed as to what was going on in any way, and in a regular way?
Well, that's one thing I've always been mad against, putting everybody in the picture. Because when you're out in the desert, things like that, you can let everybody know what it is. Because you're not going nowhere, you're going to meet nobody, and you can't send no letters away or talk to anybody. You didn't get the information dead on. The high-ups had it. Company commander's got it. The CEO had it, the company commander got it, the lieutenant's got it. The lieutenant passed it on to the sergeants, as much as he wanted to pass on. And the sergeant passed as much as he wanted on to the private. And he didn't get he should have been putting the picture same as the lieutenant got his orders. More or less. Because he wasn't going nowhere. See, right. Mine, there's about 50 tanks over there. The line to come this way or the line to go that way. Things like that. See? They knew there's tanks over that there, eh? But they weren't going to put the fear up the ordinary fella. Instead of putting him in the picture, eh? Oh, we got a bit tank experience, what they call a sticky bomb, you know, see? If any tanks come up during the night time, clack it on and they wait there for second fuse or 2 second fuse, get out or lie down. Or you got a, what they call a 68 bomb, you fit it on the cup of your rifle, and then you fire it from the cup of your rifle, would blow the track of a tank. It was mine, was a good 68 one, and would fit on a normal Enfield rifle. And the fire was a blank cartridge. And the fire was a blank cartridge, you know, and it's cooked on the end of the rifle. And it was a very effective thing for both blow a wheel off a track vehicle, or would blow the track off a tank. But we didn't get close to tanks and like that. No, we didn't. But the teaching was there for the deal with it. You taught how to deal with it if it did happen to come that way, because it was possible for such a thing to happen to you.
Was there any other form of information that was going around within the perimeters? Did you have, for example, any magazine which was meant to enlighten you?
Never. No, if you had your knife, fork and spoon, razor, comb and ladder brush, then was your only thing that you had, the personal effect of things for your own sanitation and things like that. No papers, magazine, you didn't require them, no. You got the moon, the stars and things like that.
How did all this lack of information and, in a sense, being in a place which you had no idea you were going to get out of easily, did that in any way affect the morale of people? Did they become depressed at all?
No. You will laugh together and say, well, you've been moving about that much, you know, like in your pastime. You know, different areas you've moved around. Say, oh, well, it'll be another situation later on, you know, it'll not last forever. Because as a soldier, you're always on the move, and you get used to a couple of months in one place, maybe a fortnight in another, and things like that, moving around. No, but as regards entertainment, no. St- storytellers among yourselves, the biggest liars and fibbers and blokes, even blokes who just imagine things just for to get a laugh. You know, they were imagining. And then was come dead and spin such a tale that unbelievable fairy tales and they got just for to create a laugh. You didn't create laughs among yourselves. Well, you had to really for the keep. Because if a fella didn't laugh, he'd have it. Yeah, that was some queer tales and blokes and biggest liars out and all of that. Just, with that comes to be a young part of a fella, really. Yeah, it does come out on you. Granted, because there's nothing else. You see, all you did cope with. No mail, no letters, no photographs, no nothing at all. You're out on the sand only, and it is a defensive position. And all you want to worry about that, you've got plenty of ammunition, plenty of food, you're going to clean, and if anybody's going to attack you, well, you're ready for them. You're always ready for them. Now tell me, in a defensive position.
As you have got near to the end of your time, you say that you got into a breakout situation. What was your involvement in that?
Well, the company I was in at the time, A Company, I said I'd be happy with A Company at the time. It was Ronnie King who was a sergeant, and I was a sergeant. The place would be called El Duda, the Essex Regiment. We went through that, we went through their lines, what we call them lines, but they're just a piece of ground. You call them lines, they're not lines as you think they are lines, they're just a piece of ground. You call them lines. Went through the Essex, and the chap turned them out over, and I said, hey, lad, I said, I'll put one through you, but then shut that up. Because I knew that sound was travelling, and as I mentioned before, sound travelled maybe 150 to 200 yards in the night time. I said, look at that, we've gone forward, you're stopping here. That was the Essex Regiment. Anyhow, we did, and we went through the Essex lines, and it was dark, and then we're more or less formed up as required, where to go. They were there, then we advanced. And we had to go forward in the forward area. And personally, myself, well, I knew my types of ammunition. I had a rifle and bayonet at that time. Sometimes I had something at that time, I had a rifle and bayonet. And I knew a blue nose one was set fire to a tanker. And a red nose one, like tinted red, 303 it was. The red one would be a tracer. You could see it was a tracer-fired one. And your normal 303 would just fire for the kill. And maybe explains I had them all. Not many, you only made sort of half a dozen tracers, or half a dozen blue nose ones, and your normal 303. And only had plenty. I think I had about 250 others at the time, altogether. That's about five bandoliers. You know, they just come in bandoliers of 50. But that, it stands up to come as regards shooting, and it was a tanker, you know, like petrol-driven vehicle, or something you want to set fire to and make it blare up, a blue-nosed one would do the job. Not many fellas knew that, mind, or kite it out. Or if you want to see what direction you're firing, a tracer would help you. I'll cut you on that night, breaking out through El Duda. And was he being a charge and all the night time being a charge? I had plenty of ammunition on this, and I come across a bit of a sangha. You know, they call them sanghas then.
That was what?
There was one fella, he'd already been killed. I didn't kill him, somebody else was in him. And I heard 3 or 4 hours shouting mercy comrade in the dugout. Well, what addition got to me at night time? How the devil are you going to attack prisoners on the night time and you've got to come forward? For all this, I saved myself, that'll be done. I just had to get them 10 sharp.
What's this, with your rifle?
Aye, 10 sharp.
Into the dugout?
Into the dugout. I just had to get them 10 sharp as quick as I could. Reload again, and on to the next one. Gets on to the next sangha, what you do, they were like little bits of defensive sanghas we were trying to break off at. And you could see that a bit like flares or something, or transport or something, in the far distance, and you could hear the voices and the row going on, that they were withdrawn. Well, if they're withdrawn, you're going to press forward quicker than what you think there are times. And find a way. I can remember a couple of them from Chesley Street. I got just stung in the leg. Oh, God, no, there's a couple of them. I says, I'll keep on firing. I says, just put your bandage on my leg there. And the bullet went in, and it's still in it. It's still in, and it's definitely not been down to the doctor's there. The last couple of years, it's been asleep all the time, because the holes there where it went in, and another hole where it comes out. And the OD get back after that. Everything was all right. And I was in Tobruk Hospital for about 10 days, the tendon back into Tobruk. And I got to know that the red was moving forward, so I said, hey, I'm not stopping in this hospital, I'm out. And I said, they're more, pause here more, I said, get me away from here. I said, the regiment moving. I said, the regiment was me home, see? I knew with those getting transferred to different places and different camps, and which happened a lot of times. But that regiment was me home. And I said, look, I'm limping. I said, I'll still get there. And I did. I got out. He let us go. Well, there's leg wound only 10 days.
Aye. Going into the attack again, and you'd had nights of patrols and all the tensions and that would bring on you. Did you find that courage was more difficult to come by, and the nerve to go forward? Was it receding with the more actions and activities that you were involved in?
No, you had a job to do, and you were told to do it, and you got to win it, really. Man, you were told that there's a superior force in front of you, things like that. You're always told that it was less than what was there. Sometimes you met stiff opposition, unless information got through. Well, I mean, what probably wasn't their fault. But if you met stiff opposition, you always blame on getting the right information. But then, I mean, how can you get the right information at times? You don't always get it near.
Had this attack then been successful?
Yes, that. As far as I knew, El Dude, our one was, because Orkney may come up, and then we come out all together. As a matter of fact, the Durham's got moved back, and I think the next move would be Malta. I think the next move from El Dude or from Tobruk would be Malta.
Had you had any rest between Tobruk and Malta?
Yes. Oh, yes. We went back into Egypt. And, well, they can't even name the places there, really, but they built a big camp in Egypt there. Shut up, what they call it now? Well, the big flea, what we tell them where the big flea was.
What was the big flea?
That was the Odjus officers' contrast depression, a place called the big flea. I forget the name of Geneva, they call the big camp Geneva. Well, the big flea is in Geneva, really. That's what we were there early on, before there was any camp there at all. But it was a small area based trace camp once, the area ground.
And was the big flea? Was it a fly ridden area or what?
No, I think it was a big, like a big mountain of shale. Because quite a lot of shale there, like small stones, like a mountain, but really, because you go along farther along on what they call the Kontara Depression, around that back area, that part of Egypt, which is more or less impossible.
And as relief, what were you given leave to go to some town?
No, there was no leave at all. Oh, yes, wait a minute. I think there was. Yes, I think there was. After Tobruk, yes, there was a 4 days leave, a small leave period.
And what did you do with that?
You went to Alexandria, Port Said, or Cairo. All depends what you're allowed to go. There was camps in Cairo, camps in Alexandria, for personnel to stay there, and then and get back in that type of barracks. I think we did go for 4 or 7 days leave or something like that.
What kind of things did you do on leave?
Well, like anybody else, just drinking and find the area of the town and Cairo. I think I've had one in Cairo, Alexandria, and Port Said in my time. Things that sometimes you don't want to admit. They what they call skeleton in the cupboard. But you saw more or less other parts of the world that you'd never seen, you know, wasn't back in the night in England, things like that.
Did you see many men in the services who were backwallers, people who never ever got up front, never got into a dangerous situation?
Oh, yes. There was chaps that says, I was talking to one fellow, he says, have you been wrestling? Well, I says, well, you've got to be when you close like that. He was a study that, and he was a soldier. Anybody might have been a tradesman or things like that, and he part of the war wasn't involved in fighting. I mean, it wasn't his fault. But his part of duties would be an administration part, which you've got to have, haven't you? I mean, they're all soldiers fighting. Oh, no.
Didn't cause any bad blood between...
No, none at all. I mean, it just happened to... Just like the Royal Air Force used to call them real cream boys. I mean, but there was only the Iridian laddies what was flying the blowing aeroplanes within the work, but they couldn't hear their work with one of the mechanics and that, and saying that the guns were firing and the aeroplane was in fit condition for the fly, wasn't it? I mean, everybody got to pay a little extra part.
What was your relationship like with the Egyptians themselves?
Oh, you never trusted them. No, I never trusted none of the Egyptians at all.
Is there any reason for saying that?
Well, they didn't seem to be wealthy often. And if your standard part of equipment and things like that was quite good. And I can remember even when he pulled up for diesel or petrol or whatever you're using, there's certain areas, you know, because it's just the army dump, I want so much. They were only glad for to collect the blooming tins and make money out of them and things like that. Or if a bloke had souvenirs of the war and things like that, watches and that. They seemed to be a poor nation and they would pinch any if they got the chance. That was ordinary fellas. Well, you didn't get much crap on because you kept up with them. I mean, in peacetime, there'd be certain big clothes where the upper crust would be mixed among the Egyptians, you know, there, and then would have money and things like that. But the normal chap, same as us, that they had very little. And we didn't trust them at all. We just kept them, you know, at our distance.
Had your weapons changed much in the time that you'd been in the desert? You mentioned Bren guns. Were there any other weapons that you had?
No, there wasn't a great increase in the guns. First, the O3 Enfield, then the Bren gun come, then the Tommy gun come, and the boys had the tank, which fired a .51. That's about all the infantry, normal infantry. Then other ones, well, I mean, the 25-pounders and things like that, and that was artillery and different ones. But the normal footmen, no. Bren gun, Tommy gun, boys anti-tank, 303.
What was your opinion of these weapons that you were using?
Well, the Bren gun was excellent. It was an anti-aircraft, you know, your tripod, you could mount them for an anti-aircraft gun, which is quite accurate, and or you could mount them on a tripod and act as a machine gun, which is quite good. Or you could yourself, which I have done, just fight them from the hip as they're going along, and it's quite good. It's one best little weapon I admire now.
The Tommy gun you mentioned, what was that like?
Well, he's quite good, the Tommy gun as well. He's just like the old about a magazine of 20. Like oblong magazine of 20. Then he'd have a drummer magazine of 50. But that was only more or less within 60 yards. You had to be 60 yards in, you know, I mean, or less than 60 yards, really. But 60 yards was just the effective, I would say. It wasn't, with a very close weapon. I mean, what they call it, you term as a surprise weapon. So you were doing like into a building, things like that. It was handy then, because you could get a normal rifle. You could give a burst of 50 that went in about 3. You could spray or flatten. But regards the actual distance fighting, no, it was no good for that. Not for distance fighting. I mean, when I'm saying distance fighting, we'll say that's 800 yards, 800 yards or 600 yards when you're fighting at each other. Because about 800 yards is the kind of distance for the ever crack at somebody or he's having a crack at you. You know what I mean? But then they should get to each other actually in the being the charge.
But boys anti-tank rifle, was that much good?
Yes. It would penetrate the bread and the armour what they had. If you fight a shell just like the neck of that bottle, you know, just like that, they put the same circumference as that bottle. But you were... You had one about one of them a platoon. A great deal of them knocked around. Oh no. You'd be allocated one a platoon or something like that, any time.